This is a podcast from the children's radio station Fun Kids. Listen on DAB digital radio across the UK or online at funkidslive.com.
Would you look at this then, another brand new episode of the Fun Kids Science Weekly. Thank you for listening, welcome along. This is the show that explores everything amazing, epic, dazzling and deadly that's in the universe. My name's Dan, now today we'll learn about one of the most poisonous creatures in the ocean. Also, you can hear what your brain is actually made of, you know, apart from loads of TV, ice cream and barbecue food, because it's the end of summer, it's probably full of that. And also, we'll chat to a man who has written a book on the most dangerous creatures in the world. First, we're catching up with our amazing Age of Dinosaurs series and heading to the Cretaceous period.
Travel back in time to the Age of the Dinosaur
at the Natural History Museum.
Imagine going back in time, not 100 years or 1,000 years, but millions of years. To the Age of the Dinosaur. Welcome to the Cretaceous period, which existed between 65 and 144 million years ago. More dinosaurs lived during this time than at any other. The world was experiencing some of the hottest climates ever known, and was home to a wider range of environments and species than had ever been seen before.
Wow, check out the cool flowers.
Flowering plants known as angiosperms began to bloom in the Cretaceous period, spreading from the warmer tropics where the conditions were perfect for them to flourish. One common type of angiosperm were the palms, which populated the forests in huge numbers, although another type you might recognize were water lilies, like those found in ponds today. And with flowers came many varieties of insects, from butterflies and beetles to flies and ants, and also early relatives of bees to pollinate the flowers.
Ouch! This plant is very spiky.
That's a cyclad, and it's telling you to keep off. With more animals around, plants had to get clever too. Some grew spikes. Others developed poisons or unpleasant tastes to put herbivores off eating them.
Watch out! Something massive's on the move!
He's massive, all right. It's an Argentinosaurus. The herbivores in the Cretaceous period were some of the largest sauropods ever. Sauropods had huge bodies, long tails and necks, and small heads. And the Argentinosaurus is thought to be the largest that ever lived. Only a few fossils have been found, but they show he was 30 meters long and weighed over 60 tons. With his enormous neck, he could reach the tallest treetops to strip huge amounts of vegetation he needed. Herbivores like the Argentinosaurus roamed around forests like these amongst the conifers and palms.
Oh, it's really hot here.
Even hotter parts of the world, like the area that's now East Asia, were more like deserts. Very hardy plants grew there, and dinosaurs had to be tough to survive. Either managing to eat the dry and spiky vegetation, or by preying on other animals. As a result, deserts were some of the most terrifying places of all.
Look out! It's a ferocious Tarbosaurus!
Paleontology. Pick.
Insects can help us learn about plant life, but insects rarely become fossilized. However, soft and sticky resin that oozes from tree bark can trap insects, preserving them incredibly well when fossilized into amber. Amber found in Ethiopia in 2010 helped scientists put together a snapshot of the Cretaceous woodland and the different animals and plants that lived there at that time. Spiders, wasps, and one of the oldest ants in the world were all trapped in perfect detail. Travel back in time to the Age of the Dinosaur.
The new interactive exhibition at the Natural History Museum. Walk alongside life-size moving animatronic dinosaurs and other strange creatures among the smells and sounds of the prehistoric Jurassic swamps and Cretaceous deserts. Find out more at nhm.ac.uk.
But watch out for what's around the corner.
you can download all of our Age of Dinosaurs series for free on your phone and tablet through iTunes, on the Fun Kids app, and over at funkidslive.com. We will chat to the man who has written the book on deadly predators in just a sec. First, I want to say a huge hello to Logan, who is listening in Bracknell. Hello, mate. Also to Anna, Mark, and Matched as well for leaving us a review. Remember, if you want a shout out on the show, it's so easy. Just get out your phone or your tablet. It's probably right next to you. You can do it right now. Open up iTunes, the podcast store, then find the Fun Kids Science Weekly and leave us a review. And you can say whatever you want. Tell me you're listening. That'd be helpful. Make sure that you leave your name so I know who to shout out. And you can also leave us a star rating as well. Now, here's the thing. I'm not saying I can be bribed with stars for shout-outs, but five of them might get you a lot closer to a hello. Now, on the Fun Kids Science Weekly, we love our dangerous and deadly beasts. And there's a book, it's out now. It's all about the top killers of the past and the present. It's called Apex Predators, and the author, Steve Jenkins, is on the phone now from Colorado. Hey, Steve.
Hello.
So, Steve, the most obvious question, what's the most deadly predator that's ever existed?
Interestingly, I believe it's the mosquito. I'm trying to think if there could have been one in the past that was more deadly. But right now, mosquitoes are responsible for about 1 million human deaths a year. And I guess we have to consider them predators since they're drinking our blood.
But they're so tiny. When I think of dangerous creatures, we're thinking of a huge T-Rex, a beastly lion. Why is the mosquito so bad for us?
Simply because of the diseases that it transmits. Malaria primarily, but a number of other tropical diseases that are often lethal, especially in the developing world. It's not as dramatic as being eaten by a great white shark or a Siberian tiger, but it does take quite a toll.
So what are the predators throughout history? Because your book is all about killers of the past and the present. What predators throughout time have you come across that have really captured your mind?
You know, there are quite a few that have sort of flown beneath the radar. I mean, obviously the T-Rex and saber-toothed tiger and those sorts of creatures are well known. But one example is this animal called the Didon. It's referred to as the killer pig. It lived about 18 million years ago on the plains of North America. And it was, you know, the size of perhaps a rhinoceros. It had hooves and also fierce tusks and was probably a pretty aggressive and deadly predator. And it's just one of these animals that very few people are aware of. Those were the kinds of creatures that I found most interesting.
You've studied predators throughout history. How have the most deadly and dangerous ones developed over time? Because, for instance, the dinosaurs wouldn't evolve the same way today. How have killing machines and monsters kind of moved on throughout history?
It's interesting in that it's obviously the way the predators have evolved and changed through time, but it's a bit of a dance. It's often been referred to as an arms race between predators and prey. So hundreds of million years ago, when first animals on the seafloor realized that eating other animals was a great way to get food, it was a concentrated source of energy. The prey animals begin to evolve hard shells, spines, and things like that to protect themselves. So the predators then had to develop crushing jaws and pinchers and so on. And that still continues today. So when you see an antelope in the plains of Africa that can run fast as a car, what you're seeing is a response to the predators like cheetahs that chase it. So there's been this kind of back and forth tit for tat over the eons.
When we talk about dinosaurs, you know, we're thinking of the huge T-Rexes and those other creatures that were the top of the food chain. But why did they end up being the top? Why did no other kind of creature come along?
You know, honestly, that's probably a question that books could be written about. My sense is that there's actually a bit of luck involved. Once a form of predator like dinosaurs reaches a certain level of success, it's very hard. Mammals coexisted with dinosaurs. They evolved at about the same time. But they were outclassed in terms of being efficient predators, and so they had to remain small and kind of hide until the dinosaurs went extinct, probably because of a asteroid impact, you know, 66 million years ago. That opened up space for mammals then to become large and aggressive and efficient predators. If that asteroid hadn't hit the Earth, it's quite possible that we'd still have dominant predators on Earth would be dinosaurs.
Is everything biological with predators in the wild? I mean, humans often are brutal and kind of deadly through malice. In the wild, are predators ever mean and malicious, or is it only ever to get food?
Well, that's a good question. There's certainly some predators that appear to be malicious. I mean, there are animals that will kill more prey than they can eat. It's not typical, but there are, you know, wolverines, for instance, that live in northern climes can kill a whole flock of sheep, even though they're only going to eat one or two. Whether it's malicious, I mean, that's a hard thing to say. It may be that they've just evolved this kind of predatory response where they kind of go off and they just keep killing prey, and that has helped them survive somehow, even though at times it seems cruel and wasteful.
It's very handy having you on the phone, not just because you've done this wide study of predators throughout history. Also, you're a writer, you're a drawer, you're a designer, so I kind of want to put that creativity in action right now, if that's okay. I want us to design, like, the perfect predator in just a few minutes, okay?
Sure.
Right, so I think we'll start with the legs, the bottom half. Out of all of the predators you've learned, what's got the most efficient leg?
I guess we have to set some sort of parameters here. I mean, probably spiders are as effective a predator as it exists, but obviously they're only effective at a certain scale. I assume we're talking about larger animals here.
Yeah, but we can make them giant spider legs. It's in this imaginary animal, it's fine. We can have 8 huge legs.
Although spider legs wouldn't work if you scaled them up too much. The fact that they have their skeletons on the outside of their body has its limitations. So probably if we're talking about, you know, an animal that a human might have to worry about, I would probably, one of the big cats, you know, a tiger, perhaps, with their immensely powerful legs and equipped with claws and their ability to leap and that sort of thing.
Now let's focus on the body, the abdomen. Are we having wings? Are wings really helpful in a predator? Or are we having armored shells? What have you discovered that really works with a predator's abdomen?
Well, if we're not limited to modern-day creatures, if we can pick and choose from, you know, from the history of predators, I might be inclined to go with a dinosaur, something like a velociraptor that, you know, has a tail that balances its body, possibly some sort of, you know, armored skin, which gives it some resistance to being hurt.
What about head, then? Not brain. We'll talk about the brain in a second. But everything else that comes with your head, so jaw, the teeth. What have you learned throughout the history of predators past and present that would really be helpful with our dream predator's head?
Well, if we have a carte blanche here to symbol this beast, I think probably the shark, the great white shark, has one of the most efficient, I mean, it's overall one of the most efficient predators, but if we're assembling this creature, you know, they have hundreds if not thousands of teeth that regularly fall out and are replaced so that they never have to worry about breaking a tooth. They have the ability to open the mouth really wide, take huge bites. I'm going to attach a great white shark's head to this creature that we're building.
Yeah, I'm loving it. So we've got a lion's legs, a velociraptor's body, shark's mouth and head. What brain are we thinking, though? This is the real, like, operation, the real machine in the head. Who's the smartest predator that you've come up across?
Well, that would have to be us, I think. But if we're not putting ourselves in the mix here, it would probably be a primate, some sort of, I mean, chimpanzees are very intelligent, and they have the ability to hunt cooperatively, which would help. I mean, I suppose if you had a pack of these creatures, they would be more effective than an individual. So I might choose an ape's brain of some sort.
There you go. You're next illustrator and designing. You've got it right there. You've got your legs, tiger legs, velociraptor body, shark mouth, gorilla head, gorilla brain. I'm happy with that one, Steve. Brilliant. The book Apex Predators, it's out now. It's all about top killers of the past and the present. Steve Jenkins, thank you for coming on the Fun Kid Science Weekly.
Thanks for having me.
Right then, time for this week's Dangerous Dan, where we look at the most amazing, weird, but deadly things in the universe. And today we're travelling under the sea for a creature that is only the size of a golf ball, but it could kill you in minutes. The blue-ringed octopus is a small beast that packs a hugely venomous punch. The animal is found under the ocean, around Japan, and, who guessed it, Australia. No surprise there, then. The problem is, the blue-ringed octopus is not found in deep water, quite shallow stuff. So often, people come across them, tread on them, and they don't like that. The octopus lets you know as well. Now, luckily, they're pretty easy to spot, because they look exactly like their name suggests. They're cream, they're beige, and the octopus octopus has got loads of blue rings on them. Now, these blue rings show up. They glow when the animal becomes threatened and alarmed. This bit's really cool, right? The blue rings act as a signal. They say to predators, look, if you come any closer, bad things are going to happen to you. And they do. They bite. They eject venom. It paralyzes you. Then it's done. It's over. And you're dead. The blue-ringed octopus venom carries enough poison to kill 26 people. And the worst part is, there's no antidote to the venom. No one knows what to do. You just have to cross your fingers and hope for the best. Now, in a sec, our science expert Tom will be here to answer one of the questions that you've sent in over to my page at funkidslive.com. Today, it's about your brain and what's really going on inside it. Although, to be fair, not sure that's something that anyone really wants to find out about. Right, first, we are hanging out with Curious Kate, who's always asking the biggest questions about science, the universe, and how things work. This time, she's thinking about how we use energy from the sun.
Curious Kate, in association with British Gas Generation Green. Tom, where are you?
In the garden. Come outside. I've got something cool to show you.
Okay, come in. What is it?
Ta-da!
Oh, you've put some garden lights up on the fence. Well done, you.
Hey, cheeky. They're for Mum's surprise birthday barbecue. I'm just checking if they work. But there's something extra special about them, and I thought you might be interested in finding out what it is.
Oh, yeah? What?
Well, these garden lights are a bit different because they run off energy from the sun.
Cool. That's solar energy, isn't it? I've heard about this. The solar panels look a bit like mirrors, and rays from the sun can be turned into electricity.
Ooh, someone's been doing their homework.
You're not the only one with brains in this family, Tom. But what I'd like to know is, why do we need to create power from the sun when we already get electricity from power stations?
Well, that's because across the world we use so much oil, gas and coal to produce energy that one day we may run out of all these non-renewable fuels, which wouldn't be good. So we have to look elsewhere for sources of power, like the sun. Did you know that we use so much energy that if everyone around the world lived the same lifestyle as us, we would need 3.5 Earths to survive? That's 3.5 Earths to give us the food we need and the fuels to heat our homes and power our cars.
Last time I checked, there was only one Earth.
Exactly. So we need to be careful about how we use our energy and not waste it.
So this solar energy, I think there's a big flaw in the plan to use our sun as an energy source.
Yeah? What's that?
Duh, we live in Britain. All it does is rain here.
Well, that's where you're wrong, smarty pants. Because solar power can work even when it's cloudy. Basically, so long as there is light, solar can work. Also, energy created by solar panels can be stored in batteries and used at a later time, like when it's dark. Many solar-powered devices have small batteries, like my brilliant garden lights for Mum.
Cool. So how exactly do solar panels work?
Well, there are two distinct types of solar panel, solar thermal and solar photovoltaic cells. Solar thermal panels convert energy from the sun by heating water to create steam, which then drives a generator to make electricity. While solar photovoltaic panels convert the sun's ultraviolet radiation into electrons, which in turn can create an electric current that can be used as electricity.
Wow! So how come our house doesn't have any solar panels on it?
Well, I did hear Mum and Dad saying the other day that they were going to look into getting some panels. Then our house could be partially powered by the sun during the day. And in the future, we might even generate enough power from our walls. Scientists are working on solar cells that could be painted onto the outside of walls.
Cool. I want to be the first person to have a completely solar-powered house.
You never know.
Kids, I'm home. Where are you?
Quick, hide the lights behind that bush. Mum can't see them before her birthday.
Oh, hi, Mum.
Curious Kate, in association with British Gas Generation Green. How curious are you? Test your curiosity at www.generationgreen.co.uk/curiosity.
It is the Fun Kids Science Weekly. Now, you know, right, that if there's any question about science at all that you want answered, you can let me know, right? It's easy. I promise, any question at all. Nothing's too silly. Doesn't matter if it's about the sea, about the sand, about the solar system, or about snot. Doesn't matter. Just send it over to my page over at funkidslive.com. Because then, every week, we get our own science expert, Tom, to tell you the answer. Right, Tom, this is from Gracie, who is 11, on the Fun Kids Science Weekly. She asks, what is a brain made of?
Well, the brain, the particles in the brain, the molecules, are actually very similar to the ones in the rest of your body. And the ones that are in the rest of your body are mostly carbon and water, along with a few other things. Now, these carbon atoms actually originated from the centre of the sun or other stars. When the star died, it expelled these particles and they ended up as the Earth. So we are actually made of star stuff.
And so it's gone from the stars. The stars die.
Yep.
The stars shoot the carbon.
Yep. That's a very epic death.
That then made the Earth.
Yes.
The carbon and all the star stuff was in there, which then made the cells, yep, which then have made us.
Essentially, yes.
So if you take your family tree back, way back.
Yes.
Could be stars halfway across the universe.
It could be. Different galaxies.
Are there still stars dying and still planets being made?
Yes, there are. It's constantly happening and will do for billions and billions of years.
And what are the chances that maybe some of the star stuff ends up on another planet, which then starts to grow into those tiny little cells that we first came from? Maybe not evolving all the way to humanity, but tiny little cells.
Well, we are looking for those cells, and we haven't found them yet, but we've only been looking in our own solar system so far. Intelligent life, which we haven't found at all, we can look for further away because it can communicate with us. But again, we haven't found that either.
Gracie has asked a question there that has blown my mind. Thanks, Tom. So, let's see what sciencey stuff you might have missed in the news this week. A total solar eclipse plunged America into darkness. The massive shadow cast by the moon as it blocked the sun swept across the USA. Millions of people stared up in wonder at the black sky for a full 2 minutes, and there won't be another one for 2 years. Also, Chile has rejected plans for a $1 billion mining project because it would disrupt the home of some endangered penguins. This is really cool. A mining company wanted to extract loads of iron and build a new port on the country, but the government of Chile said they don't want the money and it's not worth risking the environment. Oh, and speaking of the environment and helping it out, finally, scientists have made a bacteria they think could make fuel from sunlight and water. The cyborg bug is what they're calling it. It uses sun rays and carbon dioxide in a similar method to photosynthesis to generate plastic and fuel, which could change the way we power the world. It looks amazing for the future, that is. Right, let's get another extreme athlete challenge then on the Fun Kids Science Weekly. Every week we pit a human against an animal to see who is the best.
Extreme athlete challenge with the Society of Biology.
Join us just as the race is about to begin. We're pitting man against animal in our Extreme Athlete Challenge. So, who's the fastest runner on Earth? In lane one, Usain Bolt, the fastest human on record, who smashed records in 2009 when he ran 100 metres in just 9.58 seconds. And in lane two, the cheetah, the fastest land-based animal on the planet.
This animal is built for speed with his powerful muscular legs.
They're taking their places, and they're off. What an amazing start.
Usain Bolt is known as Lightning Bolt, and you can see why. He's off the blocks and running at an average of 23 miles an hour.
Phenomenally fast.
But Cheetah's taken the lead with his amazing ability to accelerate. This cat can go from 0 to 60 miles per hour in 3 seconds.
That's faster than most cars.
Maybe Usain will be wishing he bought his car today. It's getting close. Cheetah may be fast and built for speed, but he can overheat over long distances. Will he burn out before the finish line?
There's no contest. Coming up to the line, and it's Cheetah. He's left Usain standing, and Cheetah has won the race. He's our fastest extreme athlete.
Well done to Cheetah.
Extreme Athlete Challenge with the Society of Biology.
You can see more human versus beast battles for free on your phone and tablet on iTunes, on the Fun Kids app, and at funkidslive.com. There we go, then. That's a wrap. We are done for another mind-expanding, eye-widening, and jaw-dropping edition of the Fun Kids Science Weekly. Now, we'll be back with more stories and hopefully answers from the universe at the same time next week. Now, you can listen to all of our brilliant science series on iTunes and over at on the free Fun Kids app. And also, the app is the best place that you can listen to Fun Kids, and you can also get us on DAB digital radio all over the UK and online at funkidslive.com.
So that was a podcast from the children's radio station Fun Kids. Listen on DAB digital radio across the UK or online at funkidslive.com.